Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does food mean to you? Humans have been gathering to eat for nearly 2 million years, both for the practical purposes of dividing the work required to catch, gather, and prepare meals, and also for the pleasure of enjoying one another's company around a common hearth. Today, shared meals are universal across all cultures, but the rituals of how and what we eat can vary significantly, as can the ways we use food to communicate our values, our status, even our affections. Food history writer Rebecca Rupp joins us to talk about all this. She's got an interesting article online now at natgeofood.com called Eat, Drink, and Be Merry. Rebecca, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Every animal eats, but we humans have a far more complex relationship with our food than any other creature. It's almost never just fuel for us.
Absolutely. For us, it is social glue. We get together and share food, and what it means to us is friendship, fellowship, communication, trust, getting to know each other. Animals don't do this. You know, you see your pets eating out of their food bowls side by side, and it is not a social event. It is feeding.
Right. And we use food symbolically. We all, if you live in a culture for long enough, you know sort of what you bring when someone's having a dinner party and what you take if someone is having a funeral party and what you expect to eat at a wedding.
Yes, you do. And there are so many foods that mark so many of life transitions. You know, wedding cake, birthday cake, a funeral feast that everybody shares so that they can come to terms with their grief and sort of assume that we're all going to be carrying on. We share food. Then there are all the holiday foods. Look at all the good luck foods we eat on New Year's Day, hoping that we'll have a better year than last year. Black-eyed peas.
Yeah. I was going to say, we're unique as well in assigning values to our food, right? We classify things as good for us or bad for us. Even if we break those rules all the time, we know what's supposed to be eaten and what's not.
Oh, yeah. Look at all the guilt that's associated with food. You know, if we've eaten a Twinkie, we know we've been wicked.
How does food contribute to cultural identity beyond simply eating what's locally available? There's more to it than that.
Well, I think that there are certain foods that traditionally have bound families together. You know, if you have always eaten a certain form of ethnic cuisine, you know, what your parents cooked, your grandparents, your great-grandparents means a great deal to you, and it contributes to your sense of family.
And even our willingness to try unfamiliar foods can sometimes be a way of demonstrating our openness to other cultures.
It can be, and people vary tremendously in how adventurous they are as eaters.
Well, let's talk about this. How you have this number in the book of almost two million years that we've been getting together as humans to eat together. How do archaeologists date that, and how can they figure that we were eating meals together that early?
A lot of it is done through radiocarbon dating of leftover fireplace ashes and food remains that show that people were gathering around common hearths for certainly for hundreds of thousands of years and possibly, you know, up to 1 to 2 million years ago when we were proto-humans.
It's remarkable.
It's sort of an exciting thought.
It is an exciting thought. And then maybe that was the first sign of us really being human.
There are a lot of anthropologists that think that communal meal sharing may have been the thing that got us started on the road to civilization, that sitting down and sharing a meal led to kinship systems, tribal loyalties, possibly communication, spoken language, technology. There's a lot of technology that goes with preparing meals. And ethics, a sense of right and wrong. You know, if you're sitting down and sharing a meal, you're divvying up the food somehow. And if you're divvying up the food, there's a sense of what's fair, what's not fair, who gets the biggest portion, who gets the tiniest, first, last.
I was thinking about this because on the Thanksgiving that we have at our house, if there are a lot of people coming over, there might be an adult table and a kids table. But other than that, it's pretty, you know, pretty much a free-for-all as to where people sit. But in many times and places throughout human history, where you were situated at the table said a lot about who you were and how much you mattered.
Absolutely. For example, in the Middle Ages, seating was extremely hierarchical in upper-class homes, where the important people sat at the head of the table and the not-so-important people and the servants sat at the foot of the table. And actually, on the medieval table, there used to be this marvelous container that was called a salt, you know, nothing like our salt cellars, but, you know, actually a big sculptured golden jeweled container for the salt. And if you were above the salt, you were in. And if you were below the salt, you were out. And there was a lot of jockeying for, you know, whose seat was the closest to or the furthest away from. So you know, that still survives. So, you know, think there's still a certain mystique to who sits at the head of the table.
Yeah, and it's funny because no one really talks about it, but everybody notices.
Yes.
Why do we even eat at relatively fixed times every day? I hadn't really thought much about this, but we assume breakfast, lunch, and dinner is just a thing. But, you know, we could eat at different times, but we don't.
No, and it's actually the breakfast, lunch, and dinner is a fairly common food pattern, but it's not the only food pattern. The Vikings had two meals a day. They had their day meal and their night meal. And apparently during the medieval period, the monks in monasteries occasionally got only one meal a day. And the British, of course, the lucky things, have four meals a day. They invented tea sometime in the Victorian era. The story goes it was a one of Queen Victoria's ladies-in-waiting who found that if lunch was a little too skimpy, she got a sinking feeling around 4 in the afternoon. So she decided to order tea and crumpets. And from then on, tea was born.
It's funny that three or four in the afternoon is sort of universally known as the time when companies have their like little cake parties if it's someone's birthday. I guess we're still doing that in this country, even though we don't call it tea.
Maybe that, you know, maybe everybody gets a sinking feeling at 4 in the afternoon.
It's just time to go home.
Yeah.
So I love Thanksgiving because Americans love to eat, but we only really have this one meal every year where we can assume that the whole country is sitting down to similar fare.
That's true. And in fact, it's not really all that long that we've all been doing it simultaneously. Thanksgiving as a national holiday only dates to 1863. Lincoln signed it into law in the middle of the Civil War, which I thought was interesting because he certainly must have been very much occupied with other things. But prior to that, New England was pretty good at celebrating Thanksgiving, but the South pretty much ignored the holiday, and various other states celebrated Thanksgivings, but at various times, September, October. So we didn't really pull it all together until the mid-19th century.
It's strange that anybody, that a presidential declaration could influence people deciding to have this big, elaborate meal. But I guess maybe the country needed something like that. I'm assuming it was only the Union that paid attention at first, and then maybe after the war, the former Confederate states joined in.
I'm sure it took a while to take off.
What we eat for Thanksgiving does not necessarily reflect what the pilgrims did.
No, it certainly doesn't. If we were doing an absolutely traditional meal, we'd probably be featuring venison and cornmeal mush. It looks like the first Thanksgiving feast was a very eclectic meal. There's a pilgrim diary that records a number of people went out hunting shortly before the feast, which ended up lasting 3 days, and brought in a huge batch of game birds, which historians guess may have included a few wild turkey, but probably definitely ducks, geese, swans, passenger pigeons, which were thick in the skies in the 1620s, and then a lot of seafood, lobsters, clams, mussels, and eels. Eels are something you do not see on the ordinary Thanksgiving table.
So how did we ditch the eels and cornmeal mush and decide to focus on turkey?
You know, nobody really knows how the turkey became such a Thanksgiving symbol. There's one story that attributes it to Ben Franklin, who was a real pro-turkey guy and was pitching for the turkey to be our national bird rather than the bald eagle. The turkey, he said, was a much more admirable bird. It was edible. It had a nice family life. It was attractive. Now, there's some... I don't know how attractive they are. But that seems like a weak link to the turkey actually becoming such a Thanksgiving symbol. Certainly, it's an all-American bird, so it's nice for an American Thanksgiving table.
And wild turkeys are much smaller, right, than the giant beast that we hoist onto our tables today.
Yes, much. Even farm-raised turkeys. We're not all that much bigger than wild turkeys until, I think, like the 40s and 50s, where poultry breeding really took off. And then we got these monster turkeys with these huge breasts and, you know, kind of toppling on little legs.
We're speaking this hour with food history writer Rebecca Rupp. Her article, Eat, Drink, and Be Merry, is available online now at natgeofood.com. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with food history writer Rebecca Rupp. Her article, Eat, Drink, and Be Merry, is online now at natgeofood.com. If you've got a Thanksgiving question or just a food history question, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Rebecca, when you mention a three-day feast, I find myself wondering, how do you do that? I mean, I love food, but 3 days of feasting sounds pretty tiresome after a while.
I think they spaced it out with entertainment. Mm-hmm. Supposedly, there were contests of strength. There were races. So, you know, every once in a while, they did get up from the dinner table and do something else. You know, sort of our equivalent of watching the Macy's holiday parade.
Yeah, so there's more to it than just the meal itself. There's the gathering.
There's the gathering. The gathering has always been the central part of these shared meals. Hmm.
Can you talk about some of the ways that we use food to show off our wealth or our status?
Oh, we're wicked that way. you know, traditionally, feasts or banquets or dinner parties have been ways of displaying what you've got and ways of showing off what you have that other people don't have. They've also occasionally been used almost like fraternity party hazings. you know, certainly in the early part of the 20th century when Emily Post was writing her etiquette book, there was a lot of social mobility. And there were a lot of people who were trying to boost themselves into a higher echelon of society. And one way of showing who knew what was what, who was one of us and who was not one of us, was according to your behavior at the table. Did you know how to eat escargot? Do you know what your sardine fork is for? And that kind of thing could get very competitive. And, of course, what you serve shows a lot about what you're trying to put across. You know, there's something that's very different in vintage wines and caviar versus hot dogs and beer.
Right, which is not necessarily to say people don't enjoy a good hot dog and beer now and then. It's just not what you do when you want to impress someone.
Yeah, it's it's a presentation kind of thing. Mm-hmm. What do you do when you're having the boss to dinner? Actually, there was a rival etiquette book that was written by a woman named Lillian Eichler, I think, that was coming out at the same time as Emily Post's famous etiquette. And it included, it was advertised in Red Book magazine through the adventures of this luckless couple named Ted and Violet Crichton, who were always doing hideous things wrong socially. And there's a ghastly story about them going to dinner at Ted's boss's house when Ted was up for a job. And they cut their lettuce with a knife, which was a no-no, and Ted did something dreadful with his fork. And Lillian, Violet, dropped her knife and reached for it at the same time as the butler. And needless to say, Ted did not get the job. They were consigned to social oblivion.
And there is almost nothing quite like a meal. And I think some of that anxiety has faded over time. And our meals are certainly less formal typically than they would have once been. But there's nothing else that compares to that, right? Where there are 9 things you can do wrong that show that you are not of the same social class as your host.
Yeah. Don't tuck your napkin into your collar. I wonder if all of that is the origin of the kiddie table.
Sure, yeah, you just get them out of the way and you don't have to look at them.
Right. The lower class goes to the card table in the kitchen.
Right. These days, the foods that we tend to avoid are a cultural signifier, too, right? I was thinking about the way that, saying someone eats at McDonald's, whether fairly or not, has become a sort of shorthand for being, like, lower class.
Yes, it has. And we certainly have an intense foodie culture now that's based on who is more local than who and, who is more environmentally pure. And, of course, all these things are important, but at Thanksgiving, it can become problematic if you've got a whole bunch of people who have very strong opinions about what should be eaten when.
Right. You can't possibly please everybody.
No, you can't. And where did that turkey come from? Of course, we're all interested in this now.
Yeah.
The provenance of our food.
And we're in a position to know more about it than we have been in the past, at least in the recent past. A century ago, you knew where it came from because it was just up the road.
Yeah, and I think in a sense we're getting back to that. There was a period in the 40s and 50s where processed food was really in. Mm-hmm. This was the wave of the future. Everybody loved the idea that you could pop open a box and dump it in boiling water and wham, you had dinner or, peel the foil off something. But I think we're now really turning around. Everybody wants to know where their food came from and how is it treated on the way to table. What kind of life did your chicken have before it showed up in pot pie? Look at the rise of farmers markets where people really want fresh, local, organic food. Or even gardening. So many more people are beginning to plant vegetable gardens.
I agree with you that all those things are important, but I always think that, before we pat ourselves on the back for being so open-minded, we need to realize that if we embrace this today, we're as much a part of our culture as our parents and grandparents who thought, oh my gosh, you can put this dinner in the oven and it's done in 20 minutes and you can eat it in front of the TV and isn't that modern and classy?
Absolutely. Now we're slightly looking down on the generation that thought putting a can of cream of mushroom soup in everything just made a gourmet meal.
Right.
But things always turn around. I don't think we're ever going to give up shared meals, though. I don't think we're going to get to the sci-fi point of everybody pops a food pill and that's it.
Well, yeah, what a lost opportunity.
Yes, absolutely.
You have in the article some of the interesting research about why it's good for families to eat together, not just at Thanksgiving, but on a regular basis. Can you talk about some of these things and why they seem to have such a positive effect for children in particular?
Well, there's a lot of recent research that indicates that family meals have a lot of social and psychological benefits. Families that share meals have stronger bonds. They communicate better. The parents find out what the kids are doing. The kids find out what the parents are thinking. The children who share family meals tend to have better social skills. They say toddlers tend to have bigger and better vocabularies if they share family meals. And kids seem to do better in school, have lower incidences of depression, less obesity, less social problems. On the other hand, there are psychologists that say, despite the fact that this looks great, shared dinners are good, there are a lot of factors here besides just sitting down to a meal. In other words, you know, if you're hurling the plates at each other all day, you can't just sit down for dinner and share a bowl of macaroni and cheese and everything's going to be peachy.
Right.
You know, the people who tend to have such values that they want to have family meals have other traits that lead to family closeness.
Yeah, it's
but
sort of a...
they all agree that it's a plus.
Yeah, yeah. The question is always, is it a chicken or egg thing? You know, in other words, is your family doing great so that you're inclined to have meals together, or does it go the other way around?
And there are a lot of ways that promote family closeness other than meals. You know, certainly trips to the zoo, just cuddling up in front of the wood stove and reading a book and talking, you know, that kind of stuff can be just as socially supportive for children. But people who tend to do that kind of thing also tend to like to cook together and have family meals. So, yeah, it's twisted.
So here in Texas, Rebecca, somewhere, if not on the table prominently, within arm's reach is often a bottle of hot sauce, right, in case that turkey needs an extra kick. And I know that you've
looked... Oh, you guys.
Yeah, I know. You've looked into whether, you know, or sort of the history of our love of peppers and spicy foods. And I wonder if you can tell us some of the most interesting things you've learned.
Oh, peppers. I love Tex-Mex cooking and hot peppers. I adore. Hot peppers are getting hotter and hotter and hotter by the minute, though. You know, there seems to be almost a competition right now to breed the hottest possible pepper in the world, which I can't imagine anybody could eat. The peppers are rated heat-wise still, according to Scoville heat units, which actually is a measure of exactly how hot a diluted pepper essence is. You dilute the stuff down until you can't feel the hot anymore. And then if you have to dilute it many, many, many times, then it's a super hot pepper. Now there are these ghost chili peppers that measure in Scoville heat units in the millions. I think the hottest known right now is called the Carolina Reaper, which kind of tells you something,
yeah.
Which is... over 2 million Scoville heat units. You know, you don't even want to look at that thing.
Yeah, it seems like you'd need to cut it with rubber gloves and yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, and for heaven's sakes, don't put your finger in your eye.
Yeah.
But peppers are fascinating because certainly the Spaniards were hoping to find black pepper when they first discovered the North American continent. Instead, they found the Native American chili peppers. And many American foods, of the new American foods, when they were taken to Europe, they had sort of slow acceptances. You know, people were a little squeamish about tomatoes. But peppers, everyone loved them. Within 50 years of Columbus landing in America, peppers were in China. They were all over the world. And peppers now are such essential parts of so many different cuisines. Sichuan cooking, Indian curry. I can't imagine doing without peppers.
What's great?
We're not totally not totally bottle of hot sauce on the Thanksgiving table types, but
maybe that's just at my house.
We certainly use a lot.
Well, what's crazy about the adoption of peppers is that, and I like them very much, but, you know, there's only so much that you can eat, even if you love hot peppers, right? They've never been something that we would truly fill our bellies with. And the first people that tried them must certainly have recoiled, wondering if this thing might be poisonous.
You know, I wonder what happened there, because certainly the Aztecs love their peppers. And, there was a record of the kind of hot chocolate that the early Mexicans drank that was a mix of chocolate in hot water with hot pepper. There's a lot of experimental eating, I'm sure, that that went awry at the very beginning. Actually, you know, when you think about it, it's almost miraculous that we have so many of the foods that we have today, considering what the ancestral foods looked like. You know, corn cobs were teeny tiny little things the size of your fingernail, and tomatoes were the size of berries. Cucumbers were ghastly. They were bitter and prickly like sea urchins. And there was so much improvement that went into all the wonderful, lush foods that we have today by early farmers.
How did we start eating foods like artichokes that, you know, they have spines on them and they don't look particularly, they don't even look like they have much caloric content to them?
And, you know, not only the, think of things like the oyster.
who would
eat that?
You deep fry it, throw on a little more of that hot sauce and you're good.
Yeah. Well, you know, the artichoke, of course, is the only edible thistle, as far as I know. And artichokes certainly battle people eating them. Plants have all those prickles and defenses, so they will not get chewed.
Tell us a little bit about the peas that might grace some Thanksgiving tables this season.
Oh, peas. The original pea was a very high-starch, pithy pea. Some anthropologists think that the only way that the earliest peas were eaten was by roasting them like chestnuts and then peeling them.
Wow.
But peas are very, very old. It's such an ancient food that nobody's really quite sure where the original pea came from. And peas really didn't improve all that much. They were a standard meal, you know, peas porridge, mm-hmm. And pottages were a standard meal of the Dark and Middle Ages. But peas only started to look up in the 18th century, kind of by mistake, when a horticulturist in England discovered a wrinkly pea, which turned out to be a high sugar pea. And after that, peas started to become more and more and more popular. The peas we've got are a lot yummier than the initial peas.
Is that little nursery rhyme, peas porridge hot, peas porridge cold, is that about leftovers in the Middle Ages? Is that where that came from?
Peas porridge in the pot nine days old.
Right.
Well, you probably could have kept it 9 days if you kept it on the hearth and kept stirring.
You're going to get tired of it by then for sure.
The meals for the peasant class in the Middle Ages sound like they were a little monotonous.
But at that point, if you were poor, you simply needed to fill your belly and you didn't have the luxury of thinking as much about taste as we do.
No. No. And so you may do with a lot of porridges. Grain porridges were biggies. Onions. I think onions must have been a great relief for people who didn't really have much variety in their meals, because onions are so tasty.
Yeah, every good meal starts with an onion.
Yes. And when you're cooking, no matter what you're making, you're supposed to fry an onion first so the kitchen will smell good.
We're speaking this hour with food history writer Rebecca Rupp. Her article, Eat, Drink, and Be Merry, is online now at natgeofood.com. We'll resume the conversation in a few minutes, and you can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Rebecca Rupp. She writes about food history, and her latest article, Eat, Drink, and Be Merry, is online now at natgeofood.com. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Travis in Denton. Hi, Travis.
Hi. I just had a quick question. I wanted to get the author's point of view. So I was wondering why Thanksgiving isn't necessarily marketed as much as Christmas or Halloween. You know, obviously we hold Thanksgiving really, you know, valid and important. We all gather around the table and that doesn't really happen a lot. But it just doesn't get a lot of attention through marketing. It's like you see a few Thanksgiving decorations put up, but they're already, you know, flooded with Christmas. So if there was just anything that you had to say about that.
What do you think, Rebecca?
Well, you know, I think there are a couple of points there. One is that Thanksgiving just doesn't seem to have all the clever accoutrements that make marketing easy. You know, look at Halloween with the costumes and the candy and the pumpkins and the skeletons and the black cats and the witches. And, of course, Christmas is loaded with Santas and elves. But we don't have an equivalent, you know, Mr. Thanksgiving. You know, turkey just doesn't seem to do the same thing for us. And then positionally, Thanksgiving is in a sort of a terrible place. It's sandwiched so close to Christmas that I think it gets overlooked, certainly by marketers, in the rush just to get to the main chase. That would be my guess. Now, if I had my preference, I think Thanksgiving should be in late September. The weather's nicer. It's farther from Christmas. What do you think? Late September.
It would spread out the holiday season even longer. That would be nice.
Yeah, I think so.
So I don't know if you've looked into this ever, but I'm going to go out on a limb here. I made the mistake one year of taking an uncarved pumpkin that I had bought for my kids to make a jack-o'-lantern. It was still nice and sound and firm, and I cut it up, and it was did not make a good-tasting anything. Is there a difference in the way the little pumpkins for pie are raised and grown? The giant ones that we carve up, are they just simply for looks only?
To a certain extent, there really are pie pumpkins that are tastier and better than the giant pumpkins that have just been bred to be these perfect-looking round Halloween globe pumpkins. Are you having pumpkin pie this Thanksgiving?
We're not having it. We've taken pecans from up and down our street, and we're making pecan pie.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. What about cranberries?
Yes, we are. That's one of my, in fact, I've already made it. It's sitting in my refrigerator ready to go.
Oh, you're so good. Cranberries. Cranberries are kind of a great story. There may have been cranberries at the first Thanksgiving feast, probably brought by the Native Americans, and probably in the form of pemmican, which would have been dried venison and animal fat and pounded raw cranberries. And the pilgrims don't seem to have been too enthusiastic about cranberries, because anybody who's ever bitten a raw cranberry knows that these are pretty tongue-curdlingly sour. In fact, the one of the Native American names for cranberry was bitterberry. So cranberries really didn't take off as part of any feast for the colonists until a couple of decades later when they had a source of sweetener. They'd imported honeybees. They could get sugar from the West Indies. And by the time they got sugar, cranberry recipes start popping up all over the place. You know, cranberry tarts, cranberry pudding, cranberry sauce, cranberry pie.
Have you ever seen a cranberry bog in person?
Yes.
Can you talk about that experience? I've seen them in commercials, and they just look so gorgeous.
But, you know, the cranberries aren't, a lot of people believe that the cranberries are grown underwater all the time. Mm-hmm. But actually, the bogs are just flooded late-ish in the season before the harvest. When they do look gorgeous, it's, you know, like a sea of these bobbing red berries.
And then they're fished
and
out?
And I don't live... Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. And now there are these clever mechanical harvesters that, you know, look like sort of insane lawnmowers. whereas there used to be any variety of forks and scoops that you'd use to rake in your cranberries. Henry David Thoreau talks about harvesting cranberries with a garden rake.
Lots of pie this week, pecan or pumpkin or otherwise, will be topped with vanilla ice cream. And I didn't know until I read your writing that vanilla beans come from a kind of orchid?
Yes, they do. There are, I have discovered, other edible orchids, but certainly vanilla is the best known. And those little beans are just yummy.
And if they come from something as delicate as an orchid, does that explain why real vanilla is expensive?
Real vanilla is extremely expensive, and yes, and it's a difficult harvest. Artificial vanillas can be very good. There's quite a range in artificial vanillas, as I understand it. I haven't done a lot of vanilla, artificial vanilla taste tests myself.
I was amazed to learn that vanilla flavoring can come from beavers, the animal, the little rodents, beavers.
Yes, from beaver tails. It is not a popular source of vanilla. But,
beaver tail but vanilla.
But it's a possible source.
Does the real stuff taste much better than you said you hadn't gone around and tasted it? But it seems to me that we're probably eating a lot more artificial vanilla than we realize and not missing it necessarily.
I think we are, because the vast majority of vanilla that's out there is not from the orchids. For one thing, it's the world harvest is quite tiny. It couldn't possibly supply the world's huge demand for vanilla. I mean, vanilla still seems to be everybody's favorite ice cream. Polls will vary a little bit. You know, some people, chocolate will pop up every once in a while. But vanilla seems to lead the pack by far.
Here's an interesting question via Twitter from Angela. She wants to know why certain breakfast foods are pigeonholed as breakfast foods.
You know, that is a fascinating question.
Yeah.
Interesting. I don't know.
All right, we'll have to get back to you.
You know, certainly cereals were invented as a specific form of health food, but I don't think that they were necessarily at the very beginning solely for breakfast.
It is fascinating when you travel to another country where they eat something very different for breakfast that, you know, to American tastes seems too heavy or too savory or something for breakfast.
Oh, yes, like, you know, miso soup in Japan.
Right.
Pickled herring in Scandinavia. Yeah, there we are, used to oatmeal. With maple syrup.
Yes, of course. Of course, which somehow has an autumnal feel about it, perhaps because of when it's harvested.
Well, actually, maple syrup is a spring crop.
Is that right? Oh, you would know. You're in Vermont.
Well, you know, February.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then I guess...
when the sap begins to run.
Yeah, yeah. So are there things that are eaten in the Northeast for Thanksgiving that you think are probably not as common in other parts of the country?
Well, there are certainly regional differences in some of our favorites on our various Thanksgiving tables. You know, we always have turnip,
mm-hmm.
which is turnip a Texan-type Thanksgiving veggie?
I like turnips, but I remember my grandmother in New York serving them more than I remember ever having them here.
Yeah, my family traditionally had turnip, and I'm not really clear why. a good keeping food. It might have been just right for fall. I was discussing earlier with somebody today about watermelon rind pickles and how those seem to be something that shows up on Thanksgiving tables. is sort of a special sweet treat. And celery. Actually, celery is kind of fun because you know how we often have a sort of crudité platter, crunchy celery and carrots that,
sure.
that and olives that go with the rest of the Thanksgiving meal. And celery used to be really hot stuff. It used to be a very expensive vegetable. It was difficult to grow. It had to be there was a lot of hand maneuvering that went into taking care of it and harvesting it. So it cost the earth. So it used to show up in the late 19th century, early 20th century, on the tables of the wealthy in these things called celery vases, you know, like these great big silver urns.
Mm-hmm.
So the celery was upright like a big bouquet, because if you had celery, you wanted to show it off.
Wow, I had no idea.
Nowadays it's down to the little flat dish. You know, the celery's been demoted.
Right, it's for the dieters in the room as opposed to a treat for everybody who's come.
Right, and you can see the kids avoiding it.
Do you all do deviled eggs?
Not usually for Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
You Texans would be proud of us. This year we're doing guacamole as a lead-in.
I love that because I don't think I've had that in Texas for Thanksgiving. That's like the other 364 days.
I don't think it's normal for Vermont, but that's what we're planning on doing.
I've even had conversations recently about this. You call it stuffing or dressing that you put in the turkey, the bread-based thing or with the turkey.
You know, I call it stuffing, but this doesn't seem to be regional because I have relatives that call it dressing. Mm-hmm. So obviously we go back and forth on this whole thing. And the whole concept of stuffing or dressing is very old. You know, the idea of stuffing meat with stuff goes back at least to the Greeks and Romans, where the Romans stuffed some odd stuff, but, you know, it was still stuffing. Dormice stuffed with pine nuts, for example. Yeah, I know. They were probably cute. You know, they probably looked like little niblets on the plate.
Right.
during the Middle Ages, meats were stuffed with all kinds of stuff, often with fruit, which may be why the pilgrims, for example, were so happy to eventually adopt cranberry sauce, because they would have been accustomed to a sort of cooking that served fruits or spicy fruits with meats.
I think we have time to take one more call here. We have Mindy on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mindy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go right ahead, please.
So I just wanted to speak to the regional differences between New England and Texas. I'm actually from Vermont. I'm living in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at our Thanksgiving table when I was growing up, we always had, we called it stuffing. It's not cornbread dressing like many people have down here. We also did things like chocolate pies and apple pies. And down here I see things like pecan pies, maybe a buttermilk pie. So I do notice that there are a lot of regional differences. I just wanted to know if there was anything more that you saw there.
Thanks so much for your call. Anything we're missing out on?
Yeah, we do apple and pumpkin pie. Though, you know, I think people are mixing it up a lot more than they used to. You know, we've become, as a society, much more experimental cooks. There's a lot of, look at all the cooking shows, the Food Channel. So I think we're a lot more ready and eager to try new and different things than perhaps we were a generation ago, when Thanksgivings were a little more standard.
Yeah, I suppose we all have access to the same websites and online publications that suggest recipes in a way that before you might have a little regional cookbook that you turn to.
Right. You know, published by the local church, and it had all your great aunt's recipes in it, and there you went.
Well, Rebecca, I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and I sure appreciate you spending this time with us.
Well, thank you so much. This was wonderful, and a very happy Thanksgiving to you.
Rebecca Rupp is a writer on food history. Her article, Eat, Drink, and Be Merry, is her most recent submission online. She has a number of them at natgeofood.com. Think is produced by Stephen Becker, and today was engineered by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.